What is your name, sir? Okay, hold one moment, sir. We're getting ready for your long hearing. And I will sign the Honorable Mr. David Miller. He will be conducting your hearing at this time. So just hold on. The next voice that you hear will be that of the Honorable Mr. David Miller, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, sir.
You
hear me again?
Yes, sir.
Okay, would you please state your full name and agency number for the record?
David Hernandez, 065778.
Thank you, sir. Would you please put your name for the date and turn to this morning in regards to a parole hearing? I mean, is the organs of conduct your hearing this time? To my very far right is Honorable Michael Johnson, to his left is Honorable Bill Rittenhouse, to her left is the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, who's our board chairman, to my left is the Honorable Louis Canonis, and my name is David Neal, and I'll be the hearing lead this morning. So, Mr. Hernandez, I'm going to go over some information. I know you can't see the audience. We have victims and the Maricopa County Attorney's Office also present in the room at this time. They'll have an opportunity to speak a little bit later in the hearing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over some information, and hopefully we'll get all right. If you hear something that sounds wrong, please let me know, and I'll make corrections as needed. And then after we do that, you have an opportunity to give us some information about yourself. Looks like the last time you were in front of one was in 2009, so none of us on the board had an opportunity to meet you, and we'll find out about you today, okay?
All right.
All right, so you're currently 67 years old, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Concerning the third of four counts of attempted sexual conduct with a minor, the first sentence began October 25th, 1987, and this particular count began April 16th, 2010, and they became parole eligible for that count on October 5th, 2017. And the problem aims so this hearing could be retroactive to October 15th, 2017 if the board deems it appropriate. You were certified for this hearing on June 6th, 2018, and the hearing is for board to next consecutive sentence or after discharge. You were certified a total of seven times. You were granted a parole next consecutive sentence on November 17, 2009. And with that, that's when you became parole eligible on October 2017. All right, so I'm going to give some brief information about the offense.
And the charges.
Okay, so brief summary is that you were accused of molesting and having sexual conduct with your stepfather over a period of 8 or 9 years. It finally ended in sexual intercourse numerous times when your stepfather was age 14. She apparently divulged this information to school officials, but also an investigation was started, and he ended up being charged with a lot of different charges of adult women. But one of the things that I noted when I was reading the pre-sentence report, everyone in the back of that officer, you stated that you didn't start having sexual intercourse until 1986, when her body really developed. So you were originally charged with 9 counts of sex sexual conduct with a minor, 13 counts of sexual abuse, 13 counts of molestation of a child, 3 counts of attempting to commit sexual conduct with a minor, and 1 count of sexual assault sodomy. Everything was rocked over the floor, consecutive before attempt sexual conduct with a minor, and they were all told to be for 15 years, and they were all thrown consecutive to each other. So does that sound about right, sir?
Well, yes, sir.
Okay. Looks like, okay, my kind of information, sometimes we have a lot more than we have for you today. I don't have any sentencing paperwork or the police report, anything like that. So all the information comes from the pre-sentence report rather than the sentencing paperwork or anything like that. So that's where my information is coming from. So some of it may be a little inaccurate, but the pre-sentence reports are pretty usually very well done and very accurate. Also, in the pre-sentence report, and this is back in 87, 88, in that time period, by the time they were reading after sentencing, there's a notation that the victim attempted to commit suicide at least 6 times. And then over about a 2-year period, and you cover this, and all of those on abdomen medication and things like that. But it indicates that there was a lot of mental issue going on with your victim over this situation. Also, it looks like you have no criminal history until this happened. And since you began, no more discipline and no longer since you've been incarcerated and no minors for over 5 years. Although we have a release plan, it's not needed at this time. We have moderate programming, which sex offender classes in 2008 and reentry in 2016, so that's all we're doing. So, Mr. Hernandez, we don't, the board doesn't know you at all, other than what I've read in the packet or reading in the packet. So, at this time, I'm going to ask you if you could, so we can get to know you better, try to tell us what was going on in your life back in those days and what prompted you to commit this type of activity, sir.
My stepdaughter was, she was dealing with me, she was
should have been, there's no problems up until she got to the teenager and she acted out and, you know, did some crazy things to some of her friends. Actually, she hired some of her friends and did some crazy stuff. And we had her in Sunday to a junior tour in a diversion program where she went and, you know, eliminated that. But, it turned out to be what I thought was a good program, but obviously not because she knew it, her current boyfriend. And we got problems with that a little bit, but other than that, I accept the responsibility. You know, it was my fault. I should have never allowed it to happen, but it did, and I accept the responsibility. And hence, I've been here 30 years, so it just goes to show that, that the responsibility was mine, and I'm here because of it.
All right, so you're saying that everything before she was 14, that time period, and before that was just made up by her?
Basically, yes, because the only thing I ever did to her before that was, as I remember, it was probably stuff that they didn't deal with in itself. I wouldn't pursue that as anything, and the fact that, to do what you said, that there was a case of sodomy, and that was far-fetched and not true.
Okay, well, I think about this, like the pre-sentence you're reporting, you know, you don't have the full sentencing documents and all that. Or, because usually all of the dismissed charges are listed on the sentencing documents.
I
understand. So I don't understand people. So I'm glad I put that on the pre-sentence report. And it found a little bit that it was just totally bad information. I'm not sure. But I would get back to the point of, according to what she told the authorities when I was going on, was that this happened back, started when she was very young, was contact, family, those sort of things, and it worked up. And according to your statement, you didn't have sexual relations and intercourse with her until her body really developed, which was in 1986, and also goes on saying that the way you talked, it was quite a few times that happened over a fairly short period of time. It was just that part of it. But when we get to that part of it, it was, you said in the pre-sentencing report, basically blame it on her because of the way she was and her enticing you into starting it and everything. And it sounds like that's what you were saying now, too, so that like she came on to you and that's what got it started?
No, not at all. That's not the case, no. It just, there were things where it just occurred and happened, and I don't know if it's from the fact that she knew that I was having problems and she came to comfort me and I took the comfort a different way, and like I said, the responsibility was mine, she went on there, and I could have stopped it, but I didn't.
Okay, so are there any more thoughts from you of what you might do if she told anybody?
Never ever any words of any kind whatsoever. No force, no nothing. Stop, and then it just got to the point where I knew it was wrong, and No, sir. Never took any drugs, never smoked, never did any of that. The only medications that I took were those that took spasmy. And alcohol, I wouldn't say was a problem, but I would occasionally go out and, you know, with a social group and have drinks, but nothing that I would say that I was an alcoholic or anything of that nature, no.
Okay. Another question, since I don't have the symptoms and problems, I can't really find this out. Were you done with your prison time, or were you in on lifetime probation for some of those jumpers?
No, sir, I'm not. This was prior to any of that happening, so as far as I'm aware of, no.
Okay. Like I said, I'm not seeing the circumstances, and it's very common practice to drop that many charges, so you can have a line of lifetime probation. Let's see what my fellow board members have been trying to do this time. Ladies first.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Hernandez, I got lost somewhere in the logic about how this got started. You were explaining that you talked about your job a little bit, and then you said you were having problems at work, and somehow that led to molesting your stepdaughter. There was a leap in there that I missed, a leap of logic. Can you explain that a little better?
Oh, okay, man. What I stated was that I used to be arguing on that because she would not, how would I say it, she wouldn't ever treat herself properly. And her mom was getting there out of time because mom was getting ready for work. So this was that day when she was younger. And then later on, when I started having all these problems at work, like I stated, and it wasn't just work her, I mean, you know, I was in the process of having, you know, looking at affairs out with other women at that point in time as well. Like I said, my marriage was having problems, I was having problems at work, and it was just all falling apart from me.
Well, I think the point where I lost it was about, you were talking about there was a drug treatment program, and you were trying to enroll somewhere, and how did that lead to I lost this.
The pressures and the stress of trying to accomplish that. You know, the pressure and the stress, it's job stress trying to find a program that we could put public employees that had a drug problem into that.
Okay.
And I was able to find one that was.
Okay, I didn't make that connection, sorry. And then one other question I have for you. I see that you've done a number of programs. Smart Recovery, Design for Living, Cultural Diversity, Thinking for Change, Thinking Straight. But have you done any sex offender treatment?
Yes, ma'am. My little sister, we started sober, and I was taken off of that because we still had too much time yet.
Right.
And then later on, I went and I started the SATP, and then I started that, and then I was administered a few moves for that as well because of the fact that I had too much time.
Okay, how far did you get in that program?
I'd say just a couple months.
Okay. All right, thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Neal.
Thank you. Mr. Thomas?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Hernandez? Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, sir.
A question here. When my colleague, Mr. Neal, was reading the summary of the case, there's something that I learned along the way. It's not completely accurate, but a lot of communication is nonverbal. A lot of how people communicate is nonverbal. And you seemed uncomfortable when Mr. Neal was discussing trauma caused to your stepdaughter, and there were also references to attempted suicide by your stepdaughter. Are you in denial of the trauma that was caused to her?
No, sir. What I'm in denial of is that I was unaware that any of that occurred. Any of it. Not whatsoever. But I never was aware or told that, you know, she had tried anything. But the only thing that I knew that I was aware of was that she ran away from home. And it wasn't my home that she ran away from. It was her father's. That was the only thing I
was ever
made aware of.
And again, let me go back to, I'm using that as reference, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I know what you were thinking. It's just that I can tell that there was some discomfort in you, and I wasn't quite sure what you were responding to. The other thing is, I know it's been touched upon by both Mr. Neal and Ms. Rittenhouse, but I'm not seeing the connection between the stresses at work and molesting your stepdaughter. You said you're sober, not that that's a reason to molest anyone either, but are you saying that because you were going through some stressful situations, that's what led to molesting your stepdaughter?
I'm saying that added to the problem. The heavy stresses were something I was never used to, and it just took me out of the realm that I was in and facing another, something that I had never experienced. So that did allow that, the bonds of work and the bonds of marriage allowed me to go ahead and fall off the deep end and do what occurred.
Also, I wanted to ask, because it's alluded to in our file, but did your then wife confront you about this problem with your stepdaughter?
I believe there was an occasion where that occurred.
And what was your response to that then?
My response to that was that there was nothing what she was stating at that point in time. Because she was stating that I had done this and I had done that, and that didn't occur until after that. And when she approached me, I told her the reason she was doing that was because she wanted to come back home at that time. So I need to explain what occurred that sent her away from the house to begin with. I came down one day from work, and she was coming out of the restroom. And I don't think she was aware of the way she was dressed, but that was immature. What I noticed was all the marks on her. All the bite marks and stuff on her. So I didn't say nothing. I walked in the room and changed and stuff, and then I went on the knock on the door, and I walked in and I said, what happened? And then I was torn and into the woman because I didn't know whether they're going to try and not tell her mom or whether they're going to tell her mom. And eventually I made a decision. I had to tell her mom. So when I went and I told her mom came into the room and commenced to discipline her. And, you know, I had to tell her off and tell her, no, you can't, you know, that's not the way. At that time, because she's not my child, she's my wife's at that time, she decided that she was going to send her over to her father. And, you know, and so I told her she's going to do everything by herself. I said, she's having these problems now. I said, what's it going to be like when she's over by herself? Here, she had the rest of the family to deal with, and, and I couldn't convince her that she wanted to go ahead and send her to her father's, so her father could be in charge or trying to change her. Her father, at that point in time, was taking me with the medical family sheriff's department, so. I don't know what his work schedule was like, but she was by herself
question is, how old then, because you're saying that you deny things that you were accused of doing to your daughter when she was younger, but how old was she when you began this sexual relationship with her?
Probably 13, I would say.
Well, thank you, sir. No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Newman.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Johnson?
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson.
I tell you, I just, a couple of things. Can you just clarify a statement that you made to Mr. Neal when he asked you what was going on during that period of time? And you made a statement that this is what you said, I let myself wander and made a mistake. What did you mean by that? You let yourself wander and you made a mistake?
I let myself wander because that's what I was telling Mr. Schooner, that I fell off the deep end. And I just allowed myself to make that mistake. Had I kept my senses about me, that never would have occurred. The pressures of what I was into at that time and time, you know, it just shouldn't be able to be doing that stupid act and continue to do it. And I've got no excuse. Like I said, I accept the responsibility.
Okay. So, in response to a question that Mr. Kinnomis just asked you, you made a statement that you came in and you saw your stepdaughter. She had these bite marks on her body. I'm assuming that, I guess those were maybe hickeys is what they called them back then, but and you told another about these bite marks, but yet you didn't tell another about the sexual encounters you had had with her. Why? How could you tell about the bite marks and not be responsible for your own actions?
That's a good question. I have no response to that because at that point in time, I wasn't talking to focus. I was just focused on the fact that she had these things and I was more concerned with her, you know, coming out pregnant or something like that. And if I didn't tell her mom that happened, then, you know, first with the remedy and how it affect everything and well, there were several times when her boyfriend had taken over and I had to chase him away like at 2 o'clock in the morning. And even one time the guy went inside and I spoke to him. And then I drove him home. But
you didn't have concerns about her?
My concern at night, you know.
You didn't have concerns about her getting pregnant when you would have sex with her?
At that point in time, sir, I was already cooked and I didn't,
Okay. All right. So, you were working for the city of Phoenix, is that right?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Did you have health insurance through the city of Phoenix?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Because I worked for the city of Phoenix during that period of time and they had good health insurance and they did have services on there where you could go and get counseling. Why didn't you seek some counseling through the city of Phoenix through their health insurance? I mean, they had it. It was available.
I did see because of the fact that all the stresses that I was going through.
Okay, what stresses were you? You keep saying that you were going through some stresses at work. You worked for the city of Phoenix. You were a supervisor for the city of Phoenix. What type of stresses were you going through, sir?
Well, Mr. Johnson, I don't know what your position was with the city. At that point in time, we were doing a lot of annexations, okay? And we were doing a lot of other things, you know, as far as trying to get the city to expand.
Okay. So how did that add stress to you, sir? I'm trying to understand. You said you had a lot of stresses. And I'm trying to understand that you worked for the city of Phoenix. You was a supervisor at that point in time. And what were the stresses that you were going through that caused you to react in the behavior that you did?
Like I said, I can't pinpoint. I just know that I fell off the deep end and I did what I did. Like I said, I accepted full responsibility for it. That's why I'm here. And
So
I don't know whether I can possibly say that would make it clearer that the stresses that I was under,
I'm just trying to get a good understanding, Mr. Hernandez. It seems like
it seems like
there's some portions of this that you just Mr. Quinones used the word that you may be in denial, but there's some portions of this, sir, that you were involved in a sexual relationship with your stepdaughter. You were upset and told the mother about the boyfriend being sexually involved with her. And then you had a good job working for the city of Phoenix. You had good medical coverage working for the city of Phoenix. You had every ample opportunity to get some help. And yet, you told the mother about the boyfriend, but you didn't tell about yourself. It's almost like, I'm not sure if he was jealous of the boyfriend or what the situation was, but certainly it sounds as though there were some problems that this minor child that you knew shouldn't be engaged in sexual activity because she was engaged with her boyfriend, and you were an adult and you were engaged in sexual activity. How do you not balance those two out and say that you were wrong, you know, for what you were doing and stop doing what you were doing when you made the report to the mother about the boyfriend? You said you even counseled the two of them together that one time the boyfriend was over at 1 o'clock at night, and you say you drove the boyfriend home. I mean, I'm just not understanding the excuses that you keep saying about the job, the stress that you were going through, and services not being available. And I'm just, you know, I'm not saying where the contrast is the same. You have two different standards.
I understand what you're saying, Mr. Johnson. I understand what you're saying. But like I said, I've got no excuse as far as why it occurred, it just did. And the only thing that I can attribute to, I didn't do drugs. Like I said, I wasn't an alcoholic. I never had any problems like these whatsoever, ever. And all of a sudden, you know, the stresses at work and the kind of things in my marriage and stuff just accumulated and me doing this stupid thing
So basically what I'm hearing you say that it was the stress of work and the stress in the relationship that caused you to be engaged in the sexual activity with your stepdaughter. So if that's the trigger that causes you to do that, what would stop you from getting out and doing it again if you were out or down to your next sentence? And the thing that triggered it was just the stress, and the stress could hit you at any time. That means that you're going to violate a minor child?
I understand. The program that I take and what I did in here, the thinking straight, the smart recovery, reentry, especially the design for living, showed me the talk of thinking. You know, it taught me series of actions, the beliefs and the circumstances, and I believe that all of that, cumulative and being understanding and really being aware of all the dumb things that I've done in my life, and even the things that I contemplated doing in the year when I first came down, were, you know, because of the fact that you had these children to
live with
at that time.
Okay. That's one last thing, sir. You stated earlier that Mr. Quinones asked you about the trauma that the victim was going through when all of this was going on. And you said at no time were you aware of the trauma that the victim was going through. Is that right?
That's correct, sir. I was never informed, I'm never aware that any of that was going on.
Okay, so you just explained about the problems that she was having with a boyfriend, being engaged with the boyfriend, and being sexually involved with the boyfriend, having body parts on her with the boyfriend, and having to take her, but you didn't didn't see that as a problem? I'm trying to understand. You didn't see, you say you didn't see it, but you didn't see that as a problem that this young woman was going through some drastic psychological and mental problems while she was going through that?
No, sir. She never showed me that, so I was not aware. As a matter of fact, when that happened, I stopped everything because it did make me aware of what was going on, and that's when I stopped. And soon after was when all this occurred, and I was arrested and stuff. So.
All right, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr.
Johnson.
Any other questions?
No,
right. Thank you. Thank you so much, Honorable. Mr. Lamez, now you, as has been stated already, we're just trying to get to know you better. You haven't been before any of us prior to, current members of the board prior to this morning. Would you be kind enough, because I'm still kind of lost. I'm not kind of lost. I'm completely lost. I have to admit that. So would you just kind of walk me through, in a chronological order, how did this occur? What I mean, when did this start? You know, you said when she was 14. When did you get involved with her birth mother? Kind of just walk me through until the time that you were arrested. So what was going on? I don't understand what was going on, sir.
Her brother and I got together when she was 3 years old. We married about 2 years later, and she was the only girl in my family, and I had an two-year-old son at the time. Or 7 years old when we first got together. 2 years later, we had our second daughter. 2 years after that, we had our second son. And 2 years after that, or 2 years after that, we had our last daughter. So we had a total of 3 kids between us, and her child and my child. So we had a total of 5. Now, she was about 7 or 8, and my mother went to the post office. And she called me and she was in the room, and she says, "Can you put an appointment on Jennifer?" And I go, "Why? Why can't she put it on herself? I thought she was old enough myself." So I started putting the appointment on her, and that was at that point. So we ended up there was a problem with her. She come and put an ointment on her. So that coupled with the fact that as she got older, she started to develop more and more, and she would go into the backwards and stuff of that nature, and pop my back and stuff like that. And like I said, the stresses at work and all the stuff that I was going through at the time, just chilling and me doing what I did. There's no excuse on that.
Okay, so this started...
And except for responsibility.
Go ahead. Well, this started... I still don't quite understand. So this whole process started when she was about 7 or 8 years of age. Am I hearing that correct, sir?
Yeah,
determined the right amount of research. And why were you doing that, sir? I heard what you said. The mother asked you to do it. But why were you doing that, sir? That was before the situation with her boyfriend. Am I correct? This was
right.
This had nothing to do with her sex. This had nothing to do with sex at all. Am I correct, sir? When she was 7 or 8 years of age.
That's true. That's correct.
And it continued until she was 14, and then at 14 it went to something else, and that's when sex became involved by the time she was 14?
Actually, when she was 14, sir.
When she was 13.
14.
Therefore, from about 7 or 8 until 13, there was no type of relationship, when I say relationship, sexual relationship, involved between the two of you. Am I correct, sir?
That's correct. a sexual relationship whatsoever, no, other than what I already see. And the fact that the problem I have is the fact that they say that we actually had intercourse. We never had intercourse. That's penetration. That never occurred.
So that never occurred, okay. Let me just ask one or two more questions. Okay, so let me jump forward. Okay, now she's 14 years of age. Well, about 13 or 14, somewhere in that neighborhood. And you were eventually arrested or confronted by the Phoenix Police Department. What happened then? How did you feel? All of a sudden, here comes the police department accusing you of having some type of sexual relation with your stepdaughter. Did you anticipate that, or were you surprised? What happened, sir?
Well, I wasn't surprised because I had been to see psychologist for Sigma. And I was already feeling crappy, and so when I got there, and the police officers were there, and they asked me some questions, and I just said, yes, I've been to everything, and I was taken down and questioned some more, and just listened to what they said, and didn't do anything and everything, you know, whatever. I was disgusted with myself. I knew I should have known better, that I allowed it to happen. I mentally created the situation, and there's no excuse. Therefore, like I stated, I accepted full responsibility, and that's why I'm here, you know, and
excuse me for interrupting, sir, but what was your relationship at that time with the mother, with your wife at that time? What was your relationship at that point in time? Did you still have a...
We were having problems. She was aware of this, but I had been to her work, and she was never aware that I was there, and they told me that she wasn't there, that she was at the hospital, you know, on break, so I went down there, and I observed her with another male, and the things that I saw, I was not sympathetic with, or, you know, and I just never told her, I just kept it to myself, and that in itself distresses, I guess, just kept eating at me and eating at me. I know I should have told her, but I didn't, and,
you know, I mean, you, based on what we know and what you've said, and I believe that this information is correct, I mean, both of you are professionals, I mean, what I would call professionals. You were a supervisor for the Phoenix and the Phoenix government. Your wife, the mother, was employed by the U.S. Post Office, and somehow this happened, and you you waited until it was too late before you actually tried to get some help. If you said that same day you went to see a psychologist or psychiatrist or somebody, but probably
all the problems have gotten too much, and I made an appointment and I went down there to see him, you know, to try and figure this whole thing out, because it was really weighing on me to the point that I hadn't even contemplated hating myself. So I knew at that point that I needed to do something. So I made the appointment and I went down there. And like I said, that I went that afternoon, then when I got home, the officers were there. So I never got beyond that point.
Did you think that they were there for that reason when you arrived home and there were the police officers? What did you think they were there, sir?
Well, all the children were there, with the exception of her, because she was living with her dad. So I knew that all the children were fine. I knew at that point that my wife was fine because she was there. And when they were all outside, that's the only thing that I thought was strange, was that they were all outside. So when I got there, you know, they introduced themselves.
front of the Honorable Mr. Neal by asking this question at this point. Maybe it should be asked just a little later in the hearing. But why do you think that this board, let me not say this board, why do you think that I, as a board member, should vote for you to be paroled to your next consecutive sentence in view of all that we know about this situation? If you were sitting in our shoes, what would you say? Why should I, as a board member, say yes, he should be paroled to a next consecutive sentence and get closer to walking out the door? So could you kind of, in your own words, could you try to give me a, just a hint what I, what should be going through my mind, sir?
I think the only thing that I can say there is that not only the disciplinary relief that I have for an identity, along with the 31 years of attorney, the 31st year of an attorney on, added to the fact that I've taken all these courses that have made me aware of all the things that I need to do in order to stay on here one day. I would take into consideration, you know, following your shoes, and, you know, and understand that this was 31 years ago, and since then I learned a lot of things. I learned a lot of things from the programs that you made available back then, and I continue to try and get these programs as they come along.
Thank you so very much, sir. I won't ask any other questions at this time, but thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. Mr. Johnson?
Sir, did you just say, Dr. Wright, that you did not penetrate the victim?
Yes, sir, I never did.
So, in the pre-sentence report, because we don't have all the information, but in the pre-sentence report, it states that this was an interview that was done in 1987, and it states that you said the first time you engaged in full sexual intercourse with your stepdaughter was approximately a year ago, and that the first time that you actually penetrated her was in October of 1986, and it continued for numerous times. It really gives the dates and times of when it happened. It said that it probably happened once every time that she came over. So are you being honest to this board, sir, or did you lie to the court?
No, I'm totally honest. As a matter of fact, if you look at the court record that from Dr. Risma or the person that examined her, we stated at that time that she had, her hymen had been torn a little, and that she had some kind of sexual encounters because of her gestation there, whatever they call it. I can't remember the exact words she used. But I'm not saying that I'm about my sexual traumas or anything, but had I actually penetrated her, her hymen would have been not just a little torn, it would have been completely gone, especially if I had done so numerous times.
Well, you admitted to the investigators that you did, and then I'm just trying to understand, you know, because you're telling different stories about your honesty, sir, because you told me.
I understand that.
You told me that you were concerned about the boyfriend having sex with her. And when I asked you, what did you think about you having sex with her, you didn't say that you didn't penetrate. If you said that you had been clipped, therefore you wasn't worried about her getting pregnant. So if you didn't penetrate, right? Why would you make that? You just made that statement, sir. I'm just trying to understand. You made that statement.
I understand that, sir. You can label a person and without actual penetration.
So,
I mean,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
And it was just a thing that I did, I guess you could say, but time, but I never did a temperature there.
So any indication in the report, right, would say that you admitted to have oral sexual intercourse with her, and that you continued to have oral sexual intercourse with her, and it really says the last time that you recall having sexual intercourse with her was in the first week of January of 1987. Are you saying that all of those statements that are allegedly made by you are false statements, sir?
Probably misconstrued by me, sir, or misconstrued by the person I was telling them to. I can't remember that how that now. But the thing is, that is, you know, it shouldn't have happened. I never did penetrate it, actually. I never do. And the fact that any involvement I had with her was wrong on my part. And I took responsibility, like I stated, and I'm here for it. So,
but it seems,
I don't know what I think of that.
It just seems as though you're still in denial about, you know, the actual acts that you committed with her. That seems that there's some conflict in
that. No, I would never be in denial if I had committed, you know, and I accept responsibility, but I never did actually penetrate her, sir. I mean, legally I did, yes I did. I legally did, and he did what we did, or I did what I did, and for my gratification, and but actually, penetrating her, I was actually inside of her. No.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for your work. I have a couple of follow-up questions, sir. You stated that you didn't know anything about trauma, suicide, mental health like that until we talked about it today. In the pre-sentence report, where the officer that wrote the report asked you about Jennifer's suicide attempts, which she had done at her, apparently had done at her father's house. And the statement in the pre-sentence report is that when you were asked about that, you shrugged and stated that you did not realize she had attempted suicide and that you thought it might be because she thought she was pregnant from one of her boyfriends. Okay, so, you know, maybe you misconstrued our questions, but the answer you gave to us was you didn't know anything about her attempting suicide, but you did by the pre-sentence report, which is after the board's hearing all that. Also, in several different places, you know, it's not that close around it, but it's a way that you made statements about how many times, you know, you have penetrated her and everything at that time, you're making a statement, which doesn't help you finish it off. But then you made mention about her hymen. We went after the Bayless in the psychological evaluation, and the probation officer talked to him, and he made some statements about being thinking of danger to the community, but he shouldn't be living with your daughter's plural, indicating that you have some problems in that direction. He stated again that you just made you didn't want to have your stepdaughter to the mother so that you confessed everything. But he said he felt there was some evaluation in Bacon's part in relation to the molestation. But over that period of time, I guess there could be some evaluation whether he would say that it's all fantasy or anything like that. But it goes on and it says, now Dr. Davis is a psychiatrist to give you a psychological evaluation, and he's got all the information about you. Apparently he also had the medical report where the doctor was checking for the hymen and everything. And according to this, Dr. Bayless questioned the medical examination, not what the doctor of any, of not having any one ruling or not having, you know, full penetration, it's just partially intact. And this psychiatrist questioned that and made the statement about how it could be intact with that much intercourse happening. Now, he's a psychiatrist, he didn't work with that, he didn't ask the doctor, he didn't say anything about what the doctor made him say about why it's like that. And my experience in life is that that's not, being partially intact is not 100% proof that you can never penetrate. Okay, it may be questioned by one doctor, but other doctors say there were a lot of different reasons or physiological reasons that that could occur that way. So, anyway, there's a lot of contradiction in everything that you're telling us. And that's where a lot of these questions are coming up. And the timelines and everything else, because after she went to her father's house for the reasons you stated, she returned in the dates of all this stuff. Every time she came back to the house, it was pretty much what she stated you had intercourse with her on the visits. Okay, after she went to her father's house, because from what you say, the bite marks from boyfriends and everything. So, a lot of this doesn't really add up. I think that unless the board members have any further questions, are there anybody in the board room that wishes to speak on behalf of Mr. Hernandez? No one in the board room for Mr. Hernandez? And I'll add one more time, is there anyone here for Mr. Hernandez? Okay. Mr. Neal,
I was told that the dirt had been suspended or canceled. That's why nobody's there.
Sir?
I was unaware that.
Mr. Hernandez, your hearing was, they told you to give you bad information. Okay, this morning there was some issues that was rescheduled, and I don't know that rescheduled is a good term for it, because we had three oral hearings for 2 minutes this morning, and two of them were canceled. Yours was, the time was changed, and somebody in DOC misconstrued that as to being canceled and rescheduled. But before that ever came up, there was nobody here that signed in or anything that was here on your behalf that we know of.
Right.
Okay, so that little thing there shouldn't have caused the issues with any supporters that might have been coming today, because it all came up this morning, and it all came up at 8:30 this morning.
I was advised last week that it had been canceled, so
I don't know where that came from. The information was received by DOC today that it was being rescheduled for an hour later than we started.
Dr. Wright,
Mr. Hernandez, Mr. Simon advised you last week that this hearing was canceled. Who advised you last week that that your hearing was canceled for today?
That did not come from
the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency, and I can't speak for them, I don't believe that it came from the victim services area, so I'm just wondering where did you come up with that idea that it had been canceled. I don't believe that it was said to the county attorney's office. I'm just trying to see why did you feel that it was canceled, because we had no indication at all. In fact, the information that we had was that this hearing was going to be held this morning, and that you were going to be the first one to come up this morning. And it was delayed until for about an hour.
I just walked across the way. So she wanted to call me that assets, you know, well, now it's on that now. They're waiting for you. So I'm passing that over.
Well, I sincerely apologize to you, but we have no indication at all in writing or verbally that you should have been told that. Now, I don't know who advised you of that. I have no idea. But I can assure you that the Board of Executive Cremacy did not say that. We had it scheduled. I can assure you that the Victim Services from DOC had it on their schedule. I can assure you that Mayor Corporal County Attorney's Office had it on their schedule, and I don't know who was authorized to say that to you, and I can't understand. And even as of today, you were scheduled according to information that was presented to me this morning, that your hearing was going to be the first one that we would hear today. That was said to me this morning. Please, this was sent to me this morning. Please notify that the unit inmate, and that's you, will go first. And it does say that...
I was just advised that she came over to work and tell me that Toronto was on now, and that you gentlemen and ladies were waiting for me.
Well, I'm sorry that we did not have that information in advance, sir. So, but we must be, and I'm thinking now, we do have to be fair to you as well as to the victims. Can you find anybody? Do you think the CM3 there can verify that this was canceled last week, sir? That's what concerns me, that somebody told you last week that was canceled, and we have no idea. You don't know who would have had authority to tell you that it was canceled last week.
If you'd like, I could come and get it out of the office, and it was just around the corner there.
Okay, well, I appreciate that, sir.
Hold on.
Yes, ma'am. According to Mr. Hernandez, someone, he said CO3, advised him last week that this hearing was canceled for today. And he was trying to confirm who might have said that to him and who might have had the authority to advise that this hearing would be canceled today. And he said that was told him last week. He did not give us the
hearing. It was emailed to me by Mr. the one that works in complex. It was rescheduled.
Did they send it to you last week?
Yes, it was sent to me last week. And last Friday, before I left the office, I asked. Let me see the name exactly,
hold on, please. Somebody assumed, please correctly, they assumed the rescheduled match. Tuesday, saying that he was going to be first and that Miles was going to be continued. So that was the only thing as far as whatever their internal communication was.
That's what we had as well, the same thing that you have here. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, you said you put on the public record that was an ex parte conversation that just took place.
Yes, ma'am. The only thing that he said was he just wanted to say that this piece of paper that he had was showed that it was not canceled last week, the same thing that we had. Yes, ma'am. The only thing he said that he presented to me just for the record, this is what is on the record, is what I just read, and it simply says, please notify the unit inmate 065778 Hernandez David will go first. And that's all he was presenting to me, which I had already just read.
Okay, here's the email from Mr. Stoner. It says, I just received notification that inmate Hernandez 065778 has been removed from the hearing calendar for 7918. I have updated the calendar and the shared drive as well. The board will notify when a new hearing date is scheduled.
That's
what it says here.
And who you said that, ma'am? Who?
Stoner?
Stoner.
Jeffrey Stoner, this was the email that was sent on July 3rd, 2018.
How did you spell his
last name? And I clarified it to him on Friday.
Please spell his last name for me, please, ma'am.
S-T-O-N-E-R.
And what is his number?
His first name is Jeffrey.
No, but what's his ABC number? I'm assuming that he's a 03.
Oh,
so.
No, he's a
CO3.
He works in records.
He works in records? Where? At your complex, ma'am?
At Iman Records. He works at Iman OIU.
Okay. I am going to call for a 10 minutes recess at this time and see if we can get any clarification. Mr. Stoner is not someone that we work with on a regular basis, but we must be fair at the same time for everybody concerned. I will not call for a recess. I'm going to stay on record at this time. What I'm going to do at this time, on record, I will call Iman at this time.
Excuse me, sir. Can I let this gentleman go back to work?
What gentleman?
No,
ma'am. Absolutely not. No, ma'am. He must stay there.
Okay, is that done yet? Is that over?
No, it's not over. No, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. But you can stay on the phone so that you can hear as well.
Oh, sure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We've reached the Arizona State Prison Complex, Iman. Please listen carefully to the following directions. If you know your party's extension, you need to dial 8 and the 4-digit extension. To reach complex...
Please dial turn to your call.
Okay,
ma'am. This is Father. Oh, yes. This is CTR again from Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. And we're trying to get some information cleared up. We've been advised by the CO3 that was a Jeffrey Stoner, S-T-O-N-E-R, who's in records there at Iman, who sent out an email on July the 3rd indicating that Mr. Hernandez's hearing for today had been canceled or discontinued or something. And we're trying to find out who sent that out and who authorized it to be sent out.
Well, we went back to our emails, and Jeff did send the email out, but the email we received from Peggy had Hernandez and Miles on there, and it was a confusion on how the email read. It was inmate Miles that was postponed, not Hernandez.
Yeah, we have that email. Yes, ma'am. We have that email.
Right, yeah.
That email says is, I've already read it, but I'll read it again, the same one that you're reading from. And that simply says that please notify the unit that inmate Hernandez will go first and inmate Miles. He will be continued at the last, at a later date. Okay, so we're clear on that. But who authorized, but who said, so I'm trying to understand who authorized, and I'm not saying right or wrong here, but you authorized Mr. Stoner to advise Mr. Hernandez that his hearing would not be held today.
It wasn't, he didn't mean to send the email out to postpone Hernandez. It was supposed to state Miles.
That's today, but who on July the 3rd authorized?
Right. July the 3rd, when Mr. Stoner sent that email out, he should have put inmate Miles being postponed, not Hernandez. And he put in the wrong inmate name on the email. On our calendar that we send out, he did put Miles postponed, but he put the wrong name in the email. And we just realized that this morning when we were going back through our emails trying to find the email showing that Hernandez was postponed, and after I looked through all of Peggy's emails, it was Miles was postponed.
Let me make sure I understand. I think I hear what you're saying is that Mr. Stoner, who works in records, that Ironman, he sent out an email on July 3rd stating that Mr. Hernandez's hearing would be would be continued. And
right.
And he should have put Mr. Miles.
Right. It was a mistake. He did not intend for it to be Hernandez. And that's what, you know, we were going back through the emails this morning, and he's like, well, because he was like, put Miles postponed, and I said, no, your email said Hernandez. And he's like, oh, you know, so he admitted he made the mistake. It was unintentional. Did not mean to put Hernandez in the email. It was supposed to be for Miles.
But no one, I'm just trying to put it out here, but no one advised the board that this had happened until now. This is the first time that we...
Right. We just found out when you called this morning and you were trying to get Hernandez for cook units, and Jeff says, well, I thought he was canceled and postponed. I said, well, I don't know. So we started going through the emails, and that's when we realized, no, he should have put Miles in the email, not Hernandez. So it was, I know that causes a lot of issues with you guys. It was an honest mistake on his part.
It does go a lot further than,
yes,
and maybe even some legal issues, is that because we were not, because even as of this morning, Ms. Soto sent an email stating that Mr. Hernandez here will be held today. Am I correct, ma'am?
I did not receive an email from Peggy today.
Well, someone else did receive one from Peggy today, which dated Monday, July 9, 2018. Well, I'm sorry, no, it was not sent today. It was sent last week, okay. But it was dated for today, so okay. Okay, I am going to... before I go any further, I am going to call for a recess. I'm calling for a board members. Any board members have any questions or comments they want to make at this time?
I have one thing.
Yes.
In terms of all of these told was canceled, did he tell any of his supporters that would have been here that it was canceled? Because if he didn't have supporters already coming, he's the only one that is affected by being notified of the cancel. So, he didn't really have that until that came up. So, he apparently didn't have an issue with having heard it today. Even though he had been told last week it was canceled. He didn't have an issue when he told him about my supporters here. And, to be fair, if he had even one supporter that was going to be here, and when people don't show up, then it's, but if he had no supporters, it would have been here today. The issue of him being told that it was canceled last week should actually be moved.
Mr.
Mr. Chairman, may I have a statement?
One second, let me just say the board.
Yes, the flip side of that coin, so to speak, is that he wasn't aware whether or not there were any supporters in this room to that moment. So, whether or not, I mentioned that. Any further questions or comments by board members?
Yes, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Don Heen, Middle Ground Prisoner Forum. I'd just like to make a suggestion to the board about how to perhaps handle this situation before you go into recess. Obviously, I think the board is well aware that Mr. Hernandez, in fact, Mr. Hernandez should probably be on the phone right now instead of the CO3, since this is still his hearing.
Okay. So would you put Mr. Hernandez back on the phone now?
Okay, well, you reached records, not
the CO3. Records, please, sit on the phone. We was talking to the CO3. We also had CO3 on the phone at the same time. Okay, so.
I'll introduce myself. My name is Donna Ham with Middle Ground Prison Reform, and we are an advocacy agency for inmates. I'd just like to make a suggestion to the board about perhaps how to handle this situation. I think the board is well aware. It appears that you are aware that Mr. Hernandez obviously has a right to have someone, anyone, come to support him in his bid for parole to his consecutive sentence. In lieu of the fact that you have already conducted a large portion of the hearing, I believe, and I'm sure you will verify this with your attorney, that you would be in a position at this point to continue this hearing and reschedule it for a later date when you vote to determine the decision that you're going to make. And that would allow him an attempt to have the people that he had originally intended, if he intended people to be here, to come. It would require, obviously, everyone else who's here to be here again for the public hearing, but that would allow you to not have to restart this process all over again, since the hearing is recorded and everything that's been said so far is part of the record. It would seem to me that that would take care of the situation. So if you continued this morning's hearing and scheduled it at least 24 hours in advance with public notice, that would seem to take care of the problem.
Thank you so very much. At this time, thank you. Anybody else wish to make a comment at this time for further discussion? Hearing none at this time, I'm going to make a comment.
I do understand the issue that there was an error that was made on and some of the communication that was made by DLC had no reflection on the Board of Executive Clemency. However, I'm not sure that Mr. Hernandez had anybody that he wanted to appeal. I would just like, before we recess, just to check to see if he had anybody. I do know that in his file that there's no family or witnesses in there, but I think before we, I would just like to ask Mr. Hernandez, did he have anyone that he wanted to attend?
Honorable Mr. Johnson, please feel free to ask him at this time.
Okay. Mr. Hernandez?
Yes, sir.
Okay, sir. There was an error. We did find that there was a email that was sent out by DOC, the records there, that there was a mistake made, that there was a hearing that was canceled, but it wasn't yours. He put the wrong name on there. Did you intend to have, or do you have anyone that you wanted to appear on your behalf at your hearing?
I was going to have a few family members, but you know what? At this point in time, it's almost frivolous for I heard what Mrs. Hamm mentioned to you, and I want to thank her for that. But to go ahead and reschedule this whole
we plan to make sure that your right is upheld. So you do have that right. We don't deny you that right. So I just wanted to champion. I want to turn it back over to Dr. Wright or the chairman at this time.
Thank you so very much. Let me ask you again, Mr. Hernandez, and please be very clear on this. At this point in view of what has been said, we have no indication at all, you know, that any supporters have signed in for you. Well, we know no one didn't sign in this morning. That's very clear. We have no previous records that anyone was coming to support you, but I'm going to put that aside. At this point, I heard what you said to Mr. Johnson. Again, your own record. Do you wish for us to complete this hearing today, or is it your desire that we continue this hearing and reschedule or continue it at a later date, sir? This is your hearing. This is your hearing, sir. So I want to know what your desire is at this time that the board ought to do, sir.
Mr. Wright, I go ahead and just believe and wish for you to go ahead and just finish this meeting today, and should I have another opportunity or later day to come and tell you, then I can go ahead and with the top attorney again have my people come up. So I'll go ahead and just leave that and have you people complete the door today.
Any objections to continuing, to conducting this hearing today, any objections since Mr. Hernandez has made it clear that he wishes that this hearing would be held today? Any hearing none? Therefore, sir, we're going to move forward with the hearing at your request. And remember that this has been recorded, sir, for the record. That's the reason I wanted you to state it for the record.
Yes, sir.
And that's why I asked others if they had any discussion. Okay, we will move on to continue the hearing. Mr. Honorable Senor, you were at that point trying to see if there were any supporters in the room, and then you was moving it forward, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. I think I was confused. So I think that came up right at the point that I was going to turn it over to the victim side and the county attorney side. So at this time, I'm not sure who wants to speak or anything. So I'll turn it over to you and let you make those decisions.
Thank you. Elizabeth Reamer, I am a deputy.
Please come up here, ma'am.
I'm Elizabeth Reamer. I am a deputy county attorney at the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. I am in the sex crimes unit. There are four people who are in the gallery that asked to speak before you today. The first one is the victim's father, and I will ask that he approach first.
Obviously, you have some records in front of you. I've been hearing this. I've been in the courtroom and hearing this hearing, and so you have a lot of information already. That's very accurate. But if you can just bear with me, I wanted to give you a little history of events, and then I want to make a statement as I go forward. My daughter is the victim in this case. I am here today to explain to this board how this inmate committed multiple crimes against my daughter and how it has traumatized and caused tremendous psychological harm to her then and continues today. This nightmare started on March 17, 1987. My daughter was 14 years old and was attending a junior high school in Chandler. My daughter revealed to the school nurse that she was being molested by this inmate. CPS, Child Protective Services at the time, and Chandler PD were notified as per state statute. I was then notified and met with the responding Chandler PD officer, the school principal, and the school nurse. The Chandler PD officer briefed me on his preliminary investigation. To say it was difficult to hear the details of this, of these incidents, is an understatement, even for a police officer, which I am, a retired police officer. When I arrived back home, my daughter and I talked about the meeting with the chairman police officer, principal, and the school nurse. She informed me that it was all true. We were both devastated, as we had been crying for a long period of time. I promised her that I would handle all legal matters pertaining to these crimes, and that she would be safe with me and was not responsible for any of these crimes committed to her. I contacted the Phoenix Police Department because they had jurisdiction on these crimes and initiated a police report. Phoenix Police Department Detective Morata of their Sex Crimes Unit was assigned this case. Detective Morata and I talked and discussed how this investigation was to proceed. A medical examination by a medical doctor and an interview with my daughter were to occur. Detective Morata met and interviewed my daughter. After that interview took place, he briefed me as to his findings. He informed me what my daughter stated to him, that she was abused hundreds and hundreds of times, starting at age 4 and continuing until age 13. On March 30th of the year 87, after all interviews and medical examinations were completed with my daughter, Detective Morata and his partner went to meet with the suspect for the purpose of an interview. When contacted, this inmate admitted to molesting my daughter since age 4 by applying ointment to her vaginal area per police record at least twice a week, which then progressed to further inappropriate touching and kissing of my daughter at age 8 and raping her 10 to 15 times starting at the age of 10 or 11. He admitted to touching her breath, vaginal area, penile penetration, and showering with her on multiple occasions. This occurred when my daughter's mother was at work or asleep. I should have noted that we were divorced, her mother and I. It should be noted that this inmate, when being interviewed by Detective Morata, consistently minimized his crimes that he committed against my daughter. He never took responsibility for his criminal activity. He went as far as to place the blame on my daughter, stating that she would come into his room after her mother would leave for work, that she was hanging around with the wrong crowd, and that my daughter was being too promiscuous. This inmate further stated to Detective Morata, when asked why he thought my daughter had attempted suicide multiple times. I don't know why she has attempted suicide. It might be because she thought she was pregnant from one of her boyfriends. This inmate continued to show no remorse for his criminal conduct toward my daughter during his interview with the detective. And these are some of the other statements he made to Detective Morata. He was concerned about his other children and how the current charges are affecting them. I feel like I'm stuck in the mud and want to put all this behind me and get on with my life. Hopefully the Maricopa County Superior Court is far beyond basing its findings on past incidents, and I will be judged to be a candidate for probation so that I may still pay my bills and provide for my family. He stated his standing in the community has been severely damaged, and he has been very embarrassed, has suffered, and his family, friend, and co-workers had also suffered. He emphasized the pain and grief that he, his family, and friends have encountered and the need to get on with our lives. Not once did he show concern for my daughter or the trauma she has suffered at his hands. legitimizes what our society considers evil crimes against an innocent child. He stole her childhood. She was an adult. She was an innocent 4 to 13 year old child. On March 30th, 87, Detective Murata arrested this inmate and charged him with 24 counts of child molestation and sexual conduct with a minor and booked him into the Fairfield County Jail. Shortly thereafter, on April 16th of 1987, the Maricopa County Grand Jury met and indicted this inmate on multiple counts on sexual conduct with a minor, molestation of a child, all dangerous crimes against children, designated class 2 and class 3 felonies. And I'm going to defer to the county attorney, to elaborate a little bit more on that. The defendant was obviously given a plea agreement. It was assigned to the Honorable Judge Ronald Reinstein, who was the presiding judge back in 1987. On November 2nd of 87, sentencing was held for the inmate. He agreed and he accepted a plea to 4 counts of dangerous crimes against children, sexual conduct with a minor. After a aggravation and mitigation hearing, Judge Reinstein asked the inmate if he wanted to say some words on his behalf before sentencing. That conversation occurred, he gave him plenty of opportunity, and Judge Reinstein made the decision on each count to sends him to the maximum term allowable at that time by law of 15 years for each count for a total of 60 years to run consecutively. Due to the aggravating circumstances that were far outweighing any mitigating circumstances that the defendant provided. During that hearing, my daughter's psychologist, Dr. Adele Mayer, gave testimony to Judge Reinstein. Dr. Mayer informed the court that she was my daughter's licensed therapist and was seeing and treating her for severe child abuse crimes. Dr. Mayer testified in open court that my daughter is one of the most traumatized individuals that she has ever seen in her practice. She further stated and testified that my daughter was exhibiting both grade trauma syndrome and child molest syndrome, severe depression and anxiety, eating disorders, suicide tendencies, and PTSD are some of the main trauma issues that my daughter was being treated for. Dr. Mayer recommended hospitalization for my daughter's treatment at that time. My daughter's psychological issues continue to this day. Now, this inmate is here requesting leniency. I find it ironic that my daughter continues to live this nightmare and trauma on a daily basis. The ripple effect of my daughter's trauma continues today, extending to her children, her husband. And as recently as the past 2 years, she has been hospitalized twice for intensive patient therapy out of state due to her continued severe psychological and physical trauma. She is presently in intensive outpatient therapy. Her symptoms continue to be so severe that she is now on permanent disability. I asked the board, when does my daughter get a reduction in her life sentence? In 2002, there was another parole hearing in which the inmate was entitled to. In front of this board, not presently this board, but the Clemency Court. And he received one. I was not aware that this had occurred, and furthermore, he was granted a victory. I believe they call it a 412B hearing. I want to make it perfectly clear the reason why I was present at that hearing. I was misinformed when this inmate would be eligible for his first parole board hearing, as I was not well versed on the rules and procedures for when this inmate could be granted one. Therefore, not I or anyone else were present to oppose his reduction in sentencing time. I can only presume the parole board back in 2002 felt that since no one was present to oppose this inmate's reduction in sentence, they approved him. Consequently, he received a reduction of 7.5 years off a 15-year sentence. My daughter and I have since asked to be added to the victim's notification list so that we could be present for any future hearings in front of this board. My closing arguments are that I am outraged that this pedophile, child molester, rapist has received any type of early release from the original 60-year sentence. I, as well as my daughter, are opposed to any type of reduction of sentence from this monster. He deserves no mercy, no leniency today forever, as he showed none to my daughter. As Judge Feinstein stated at sentencing and told the defendant, you have forfeited your right to live in society. I am here today to ask you, the board, to reject any reduction in time of his sentence and deny him parole. I will also be here in any future parole hearings to object and oppose any reduction in time, because I will not make that mistake again and not be here to defend my daughter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? No questions. Thank you, sir.
And just to clarify, I do have a letter to read on behalf of the victim, Jennifer. The other two people in the room are Mary and Ruby. Mary is Dane's wife, and Ruby is her sister. They will not be addressing the court today. So after my letter, that will be it. Dear honorable members of the Board of Executive Clemency, my name is Jennifer Ann Marin. Parentheses, Melendez. I was the victim of inmate number 65778, David Melendez, and am writing in response to the early release letter for this inmate. I ask that early release for his sentence not be granted. In this letter, I will be addressing him as inmate number 65778 and or him and nothing other. I will be giving you a vague backup of my childhood history, living in the same home with him for over 10 years. Inmate number 65778 had taken my innocence as a child in many ways. The heinous acts he had done unto me as a child were nothing more than paralyzing for my body and mind. He treated my body as it were an adult woman's body, and with the same hand disciplined me. The abuse he vented was very well-rounded with no discrimination. Current day, I'm married almost 20 years, two beautiful children. I'm blessed to be living where I am today, but it comes with much heat. Because of the trauma inmate 65778 bestowed onto me at a young age, I had developed an almost natural hatred for my body and did not know why. I can remember being in grade school age, looking at my body with disgust, repulsion. What was wrong with me? Why am I different? Did I do something to cause a 6'4" grown adult man to want to violate me? These were some of the same questions that still haunted my mind up into my 30s. My relationship with who became distressed. I was often told by the enemy I could not leave the kitchen table until I finished everything on my plate. I soon lost my natural hunger and fullness cues. At around the age of 11 is when I developed an eating disorder, parentheses ED. I've been battling for 34 years. Also, I was diagnosed by my physician, Dr. James Hicks, with PTSD, depression, and anxiety, as well as ED. In 2016, I was advised by my medical team that I needed to enter an ED residential treatment facility for the sake of my health. I did not want to go, but I did. I had to help heal myself and show my kids that sometimes you need to work on yourself, and that's okay. It's not selfish. I spent over 6 weeks in early 2016 and went again in 2017 away from my home and family. Kids, husband, loved ones, working hard on my recovery. I told myself that if I was away from my family, I was going to fight and fight hard. I'm still battling. I battle every day, every meal. I'm on a journey of trying to have more compassion for myself, being gentle with my body, mind, and soul. I'm still picking up broken pieces. I've gone to extreme measures of self-cleaning, end quotes, that I had 2 major surgeries to repair a perforated septum. This is part of the body work that I'm currently seeking help for as well. The elements that have chased me since childhood are real. I do look forward to the day that I can move past these ailments and will continue to deal and battle on a daily basis. Not only was my childhood impacted, but my life to date has been one challenge after another. I am very grateful to my husband, who has journeyed with me through these most difficult times. It is through his emotional and financial support that I was able to receive the professional help that I needed and continue to seek out. Inmate number 65778 did not grant me monies to pay for the damage he has done. As you can see, he has not put much undeserved burden on more than just I. Since receiving this letter from the Board of Executive Clemency, I have been experiencing distressful flashbacks and some of the maladaptive behaviors mentioned above, including self-harm thoughts. My sleep has been impaired, waking up at 2:30 a.m. every day, only getting as much as 3 to 3.5 hours of sleep a night. I've been held captive too long, trying to fight these inner demons off, to worry about inmate number 65778, receiving an early release from his sentence. Again, I ask the board to make the determination of keeping the sentence as is and not granting early release of any kind. I sincerely thank the board for your time and understanding of my input. Regards, Jennifer and Aaron.
No questions? Thank you.
Again, I am Elizabeth Weaver, and I am a deputy county attorney at the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. There has been some discussion of the pre-sentence report that was generated in this case. I have extra copies if anyone needs one, because I do plan to address portions of the PSR when I speak to you today. I am asking that this board deny the defendant's request. The sentence in this case is not clearly excessive. The sentence is appropriate for the crimes that this defendant and this inmate have committed. We are not here to rehash the facts, but they are, of course, important. This is a case of long-term sexual abuse that included sex with a child. There have been many inconsistent statements made about the abuse on behalf of the inmate. It has already been mentioned that when he spoke to the police, he admitted to having sex with his stepdaughter. He said to the police that he had sex with her 10 or 15 times. That is noted in the pre-sentence report. will note that page one of this pre-sentence report lists the defendant's height at the point that this case were pending sentencing as 6'4", which the victim noted in her letter to you. It also lists his weight as 260 pounds. I mention that so that when you're thinking about this abuse, you can picture in your head the size of the man forcing sexuality onto this child. The pre-sentence report notes on page three, the very first paragraph, that this inmate's statement was that the sexual relationship didn't happen until last year when her body was really developed. But then he had had sexual intercourse with her about 10 or 15 times. Obviously, that is not what this inmate is telling you today. I had access to a copy of the transcript from the sentencing hearing. Because of how old this case is, there are a lot of documents that I wasn't able to get access to. But I would like to note that on page 12 of the sentencing transcript, the court says to the inmate, and this is a direct quote, "So you are saying today really the only reason that Jennifer is in the situation that she is in is because of one incident where you thought that it was your wife, but it wasn't her, it was your daughter." This inmate's answer to the court is, quote, "That's true," unquote. We are here in part to have a discussion about whether the defendant, this inmate, has taken responsibility for the things that occurred in this case. I would submit to you that he has not. That his story continues to change. That it changes to his perceived benefit. And that he says to the people speaking to him what he believes they want to hear in an attempt to get less punishment out of them. It also notes in the pre-sentence report that there were attempts of suicide by the victim. It notes, as was previously mentioned, that her counselor said she is one of the most traumatized individuals that that counselor had ever seen. What I know to be true, because I have been in the sex crimes unit at the Maricopa County Attorney's Office for more than 5 years, is that the level of trauma that a victim experiences is often based on a few things. One of them, and one of the large factors to determine the level of trauma, is the relationship the perpetrator has on their victim. In this case, the perpetrator was someone related to the victim, someone married to the victim's mother, someone this victim was dependent on for shelter, for food, for clothing. Was this inmate the only person she was dependent on? No. She had a mother. She, of course, had her father. But she was living with her perpetrator. This perpetrator was able to manipulate the home enough that he was able to abuse her within her own home. The one place she should have been safe was the place she wasn't safe at all. Another aspect of trauma is the level of abuse. Is it surprising to me that she has the level of trauma she does? No. Because the trauma was perpetrated by someone in her home, someone she was supposed to love, someone she was supposed to rely on for her care, and because of the level and long-term aspect of this abuse. The victim has been clear about when the abuse began. The defendant has not been clear about that. In fact, he was not clear in this hearing. At one point, he said it was 14, and at another, he said age 13. Regardless of that, this is long-term abuse. It lists in the PSR, the pre-sentence report from the time leading up to sentencing, that at that point, meaning victim had attempted suicide on at least 6 occasions. That she was afraid that the defendant would retaliate. She was afraid of trial. She was afraid of the entire process. As this board knows, the victim is one of the considerations that a prosecutor's office uses when determining what plea is appropriate. The entire case is, of course, considered. The strengths and weaknesses of the case are, of course, considered. So is the health of the victim. Here, the victim was having an extraordinarily difficult time as a child, dealing with the sexual abuse going on at home. The state allowed the defendant to plead to 4 counts of attempted sex conduct with a minor. Of course, the indictment had far more counts than that. That is one of the things that has to happen in a plea, right? If the state were to offer you an opportunity to plead guilty to everything you're charged with, you would never do that. So what the state agreed to is in exchange for dismissing around 30 counts, the state would agree to allow the defendant to plead to attempts instead of full counts, and to arrange that the court was allowed to determine at the point of sentencing. So what he pled to is, of course, the attempt counts. But he was charged with many counts of sex conduct with a minor, which are Class 2 dangerous crimes against children, many counts of sex abuse, many counts of molestation, 1 count of sex assault, and many counts of attempt sex conduct with a minor. The calculation I have based on the information I was able to obtain is that after trial, the defendant would have served a minimum sentence of 98.25 years. His max sentence would have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. The minimum he could have gotten is 98.25 years, and that would have been a flat sentence, meaning that he would not have been eligible for release early. Instead, what the state agreed to do, so that the victim would not have to go through trial, so the state would not have to proceed with the entirety of the trial, is offer him an opportunity to, instead of getting maybe a few hundred years after a judge and jury had to watch this witness, this victim, go through a trial, was give him the plea agreement. In the PSR, the doctor previously mentioned, Dr. Bayless, talks about the fact that he did not view the defendant as a danger to the community, says that the defendant did not want to drag his daughter through the mud, that he felt some of the things were exaggerated, in part because the victim's hymen was still partially intact. This, of course, is a document from the 1980s. It is now 2018. The information that we now have about the effects of childhood sexual abuse and a child's body are much different than they were in the 80s. Now, if a child is, or an adult, is alleging a sexual crime, they are to be seen by someone with a specialized knowledge in handling sex abuse cases. What I mean is that if a rape victim, an adult, were to go to the ER and say to the ER, I need to see a doctor, I am a victim of rape, the doctor's office will call 911, the hospital would call 911, and they would treat anything that is maybe life affected. What they would not do is a full exam of the rape victim, because they don't have the specialized knowledge that is required and that victim deserves. More than that, if a child is alleging childhood sexual abuse and the parents take that child to the ER, that child will not be seen by a pediatrician but for life-altering injury. Why? Because a pediatrician does not have the specialization, does not have the knowledge necessary. necessary to do the exam appropriately of a child who might be a victim of childhood sexual abuse. What that means is that there will be a call out. Someone with that specialized training will be asked to either come to an ER if necessary, or to go to a specialized place where the victim is brought so this exam can be done. I mention this because this statement about the hymen is shocking to me as someone who was not in this arena of work in the 80s. What the experts that I put on the stand all the time say about the hymen is that it is never closed. The hymen is not something that breaks or rips during sexual contact. In fact, what these experts say is that if a child has a completely closed hymen and a doctor realizes that, the child will be put under anesthesia and then surgically the hymen will be broken. Why is that? Because if a hymen is closed, then nothing can exit the vaginal canal. And there are a lot of things for women that need to exit that canal. Of course, a baby. But more than that, and what is medically necessary, is that other things be allowed to exit as well, like a menstrual cycle. So this idea that the hymen is closed, that this doctor who is a psychologist and not a medical doctor is commenting on a child's hymen is outrageous. What we know today in 2018 is that there are studies that have been done on whether the hymen is injured in children who have been sexually assaulted. Some of the most paramount studies deal with child pornography. That is to say, videos of children being penetrated who are then immediately seen by a specialized doctor. And in those studies, many of those children do not have injury. Often that blows people's minds because you would think that there would be. But the truth is that there often isn't. So for this inmate to rely on a psychiatrist or a psychologist to convince you that penetration did not happen in this case because the victim's hymen wasn't damaged enough is an idea from the 1980s. The science of the year 2018, the medicine of the year 2018, says that that is flat out not true. The hymen is just skin that is around the vaginal canal. It is often not very thick. It certainly is not closed. Again, if it were to be, that would be a medical condition that needs to be corrected by putting the child under anesthesia. The things that these doctors, pediatricians, and nurses need to know when evaluating a patient of childhood sexual abuse or adult rape are important. And that is why in 2018, we do not allow family care physicians to evaluate these patients. We do not allow ER doctors and nurses to evaluate these patients. That is not because those doctors and nurses are not good at their job. It's that they don't have the specialization necessary. There is a discussion in the pre-sentence report about on page 9 about the fact that the defendant entered an Alford plea, and I wanted to make sure that I addressed that today so that we can have a discussion if the board wants to have one about what an Alford plea is. We are here in part to discuss whether the defendant is taking responsibility, taking accountability for his actions. I submit to you that he is not now doing that, that today he's done anything but that, and I'll discuss that in a moment. But it is important, I think, to talk about what the defendant did at the point that the plea was taken. There are different types of pleas that can be offered by the state and entered by a defendant. One of them is called a guilty plea. And that is when the defendant is required to admit his guilt to the crimes listed in the plea agreement. That is not what the defendant took in this case. it is called a no-contest plea. And no-contest pleas are generally offered to someone who has an inability to perceive at the time. An example would be, say, someone is high on drugs or very, very drunk, and they honestly just cannot remember the details of what happened. So they can't admit their guilt because they, in their mind, cannot recreate what happened. But they're not saying it didn't happen. They're just saying they weren't able to gather the information and keep it, and as they stand there before the court, don't really have the ability to put the pieces together. So the state may, in that case, say, okay, we're not going to make you plead guilty because of these other circumstances. We're going to give you a no-contest plea. What that means is that you're saying that you're not contesting it happened, the no-contest part of it. You're not saying it's wrong. You're saying, I just can't put it together in my head. Another kind of plea is an Alford plea. These pleas are no longer used in my jurisdiction. The courts don't accept them. The prosecutor's office does not offer them. I would be surprised if in any jurisdiction in Arizona anyone uses Alford pleas. An Alford plea is a plea in which you are not taking responsibility. You are not saying you did it. You are not saying I probably did it, but I can't remember because I was under an influence. Instead, what you are saying is, look, I get that the evidence shows I did it. I'm not saying I did it, but I'm acknowledging that were this to go to trial, the evidence would show that I did these things. For whatever reason associated with this case, that is the plea that the defendant was given. That is the plea that the defendant and the inmate in this case accepted. Was he required to say, yes, I did these things, yes, I am guilty? No, because he did not take a guilty plea. They were used sort of back in the day, in my estimation, when there were defendants who just didn't want to take responsibility, but the state was really invested in the idea of the case pleading. So it was a workaround, so that no one had to say they did anything wrong, but the state could save the victim from having to testify, and we could save the resources of a trial. Everything about what you've heard today shows to you why the state at that time might have considered an Alford plea. You know from the document and from what has been said here today how poorly the victim was doing because of the sexual abuse this inmate perpetrated on her. So clearly the state made the decision at that time to allow an Alford plea so that this case did not go to trial. At sentencing, the judge noted that there was no prior criminal history as a mitigating factor, and for aggravating factors, considered the severe emotional trauma to the victim, the emotional trauma to the family, specifically the victim's father, the number of times the inmate abused the victim, and not only the amount of times, but the amount of time lapse, the length of time that this abuse happened. There is a note, the judge makes, that there is no reason to run the counts concurrent. They need to be run consecutively, the sentencing judge decided. Nothing has changed in that regard, I submit to you. The granting of the request by the inmate is harmful to the victim. What it says to this victim is that her abuse was not worth the full sentence, that the abuse wasn't bad enough to warrant the sentencing judge's decision-making be upheld. That was already done once. In this case, the board already decided once that her abuse was not worth the full sentence. The state asks that that not be done again. It's important to take in what was said by the inmate today. inmate said is that he had a problem with his job. There was stress about annexation and having, if I understood correctly, to implement a drug treatment program. And that was his downfall. The state submits that many people have stressful jobs and they don't have sex with their 12-year-old stepdaughter. The defendant, an inmate in this case, notes that there were problems in his marriage. Many people have problems in their marriage and do not have sex with a child. The inmate notes that the victim was acting out and decided to make part of this hearing about the victim's sexuality and suggesting that that has something to do with this. That sex shaming the victim somehow excuses his behavior. The bottom line is that stress and a stepdaughter that has a boyfriend does not make someone interested in having sex with a child. A child, I will point out, that he has essentially helped raise since she was a toddler. The inmate noted that he wandered, as though what this really is that he cheated on his wife and not that he had sex with his stepdaughter. There's a lot of blame being placed here. Yes, from time to time, the inmate said, I take full responsibility, but he said that in the same breath as blaming the victim and blaming stress and blaming his job. To suggest that a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old needs her stepdad to apply cream to her vagina is outrageous. What this inmate could have done when asked whether he should apply cream to the vagina of his stepdaughter is say no. This inmate chose to say yes. We can read into why he may have said yes, and that is because he wanted to have sexual contact with her. Something he had admitted over the years, although in different ways and in different forms and at different times. The state would submit that the treatment the defendant and this inmate has talked about participating in DOC has done nothing to get this person to the place where he can articulate why he did these things, articulate how he is the one and only person responsible for them, articulate what he's going to do to make sure this never happens again, and to articulate an amount of remorse about these actions, none of which have happened today. This inmate stole the victim's childhood. He stole her mental health. He took her to such a dark place that she felt she could not live anymore. And while the person that did these things to her is asking for your lenience and to let him move on from one of these acts, the state asks that you not do that. There was a question asked by one of the board members, or perhaps a statement about whether there are lifetime probation tails associated with this case. As far as I can read the documentation from that time, there are no probation tails. One thing that I will note just for a moment is that there's sort of a general process in how childhood sexual assault and sexual victimization happens. It sort of all happens the same way. And one of the stages in that process is called grooming. So one, the perpetrator needs to get access to a child. The idea that most people that are sexually abused as a child are abused by the guy in the van with the puppies is just not, it's not true. Children are abused by someone that they know. They're abused by someone who has built a relationship with their family if they're not actually physically in the family already. And are people who have trust within the caretaker of the child. That's what happened in this case. Initially, the mom of the victim wouldn't probably have had any reason to believe that anything was going on, and this is her husband, and these are their children, and so she's going to allow them around her own daughter. Once you get access, what a perpetrator often does is groom. What that means is blur the lines of sexuality. Push the limit to see what will happen. That has a really distinct effect often on the victims. Because initially it will seem like it's okay behavior. It will be in the form of wrestling and then the hand grazes. And the kid doesn't really know how to handle that, doesn't know if it's good or bad, was it an accident, was it not, so they don't tell. So then the grooming, it gets further and further and further. Do I have any shock over the fact that this inmate is saying that all he was doing was putting cream on the vagina? No. What effect does that have on the victim? It makes the victim feel like they don't have control over their own body. It makes the victim confused about whether this is sexual, is it not? Is this allowed, is it not? And what it tells a perpetrator often is that I can push the limit further and further and further. It's part of the game. And this inmate was very good at it. He put everything in place, made a situation where the victim felt like she couldn't come forward, felt like she couldn't tell anyone, felt like she had to withstand the abuse to her own detriment. All of that was accomplished by this inmate, who now suggests to you that he's taking full responsibility and therefore should be given a benefit. This inmate has no understanding as to why this happened. That has been made clear today. No plan is to stop this in the future. Nothing has changed in any substantial way since the sentencing. Either in how the inmate is viewing it, or how the victim has had to continue to withstand the trauma of this. The legislature has deemed the sentence that this inmate got is appropriate. Just on the face of it, right? Because what we're dealing with is sexual abuse against a child. One of the considerations for the board is the punishment too harsh? Is it appropriate for the conduct? Is there a reason to give the inmate a discount? The state submits to you that the sentence is not extremely harsh, that it is appropriate based on the facts of this case, based on the harm to everyone involved except the inmate, and based on the inmate's continued inability to explain in any way that makes any sense why he is here. Therefore, the state asks that you deny his request.
This is kind of unrelated off of it, but what was the reason? Mother ever prosecuted or what happened?
Just a moment. Is it okay if he speaks?
Yes.
Okay.
To my recollection.
Please state your name again, sir.
Sir?
Please state your name again for the
record. Oh, I'm sorry. Daniel Williams, I'm the father of the victim. That's a great question. And when I was talking with Detective Murata of the Phoenix Police Department, I asked him that. I says, you know, we're both police officers, obviously, and we understand how investigations work. So I asked him that question that you're raising. And did my ex-wife, did my daughter's mother have any knowledge of this or complicity in it? We had no evidence to support that other than theories and gut instincts. I submit to you, the board, that he had thoughts, and his answers were yes. His intuition was indicating to him, and there were some flags that how could she have not missed this and seen this. Did we feel, he and I, that she committed any crimes to my daughter? No, I think we were pretty in agreement with that. But did she have some knowledge? I think we both said yes, but because, and the county attorney, the deputy county attorney can explain those dynamics involved and breaking up of a marriage and other children involved and the support systems and all that. She chose to stay there and be quiet about it until it was, you know, too late, and my daughter got to a point where she disclosed, and then, as you know, the rest, how the rest.
Thank you.
All right, Chief.
No questions? Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Hernandez. So, everybody has had their opportunity to speak. So we're nearing the end of your hearing. We'd like to give you an opportunity to make a final statement at this time before we go into discussion to make a determination. We just ask, and this is for the time management, that you don't repeat the information you've already given us. But if you have something else you'd like to say to us, now is your opportunity.
To Christian, the only thing I can say is that I've stated everything that I stated. I've accepted responsibility, and I have no further comment.
Okay, thank you, sir. And before we get ready into discussion, we'll be talking amongst ourselves. If you think we're addressing you, but we won't be, we'll be discussing your case. But we'll ask you to stay on the phone. You can listen to the entire conversation and the outcome as it happens. Once we bring this in, I'll get back with you, and we'll finish it up, okay?
Sure, thank you.
The board is now in discussion. So this is definitely an unfortunate situation. It was very tragic in the affecting side on the victim. And I think we didn't match the detail of the case. During the discussion, it's, in my opinion, pretty heinous to give any of this to a child, especially one that you're, an authority figure, a position of authority. I will say, I'm not convinced that Mr. Hernandez really, to this day, accepts the gravity of what's going on, and the effect it's having on the victim. And to this day, she's sounds like she's having a very hard time dealing with it. But I have to agree with the idea that he's asking for reduction in her sentence, and that's something that not how many times the victim asks for sentence or other behaviors. Hopefully, your counsel can do the work that she can deal with it, but it's never gone and never been reduced, and she'll never get out of her prison. But inconsistencies in the story and just sense of lack of ownership. I mean, he says he takes responsibility, but it's just not convincing to me that he's really accepting the gravity of what he did. It's almost like, oh, it's okay. His band was not real bad. And I just was fine. I'm not in favor of bringing a pro-tenant from second sentence or an absolute discharge. And I know there was some discussion from my fellow board member. Mr. Jones.
Yes, I would believe this, Mr. Neal. I guess I just want to add, and I'm sure you said already said a variation of this, but regardless of what Mr. Hernandez describes as personal accountability, I certainly assess a wide denial about the events in totality of this case, and I have serious concerns about his ongoing condition as a child sex offender. And I will leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Mouse.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I'm just troubled by the inconsistencies from the pre-sentence investigation to what Mr. Hernandez tells us today. And I would not, based on that, I would not recommend any clemency from the board.
Thank you. Dr. Day.
I agree with our distinguished colleagues.
Thank you, sir. Okay, so at this time, based on everything we have here in the discussion, I'm going to move to deny Mr. Hernandez a parole to make consecutive sentence or absolute discharge at this time, and given the date of the crime's charge, I'm going to ask for one year set off.
Second.
Agree.
Agree.
Agree. And the reasons would be serious media things, traumatism, and babyism. And in my opinion, this type of crime and victim harassment was broken on.